When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and CFRC's Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hench. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, providing an update on the future of Kingston's Integrated Care Hub.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Tuesday meeting, Council approved $500,000 to support shelter operations at the Integrated Care Hub and future Heart Hub through March of next year. Council also approved up to $70,000 to help cover lease and facility costs associated with the closure of consumption and treatment services at 661 Montreal Street. The CTS program is set to close on September 30th as provincial funding comes to an end. In the same meeting, Council also received an update on the city's multi-part response to the closure, first approved in May. As part of that update, staff reported that closure of CTS is not expected to affect the 24 low-barrier shelter beds funded by the city currently operating at the ICH. Those beds will continue under the future Heart Hub model, supported by the funding approved Tuesday. Council also heard the results of a legal assessment examining whether the CTS closure warranted a municipal emergency declaration. Staff concluded that an emergency declaration would be unlikely to improve the situation or secure additional provincial or federal support, and therefore is not recommended. One area that drew debate involved a planned $350,000 pilot project fund intended to support new community-led approaches to reducing harm and addressing service gaps left by the CTS closure. Councillor Jeff McLaren introduced an amendment aimed at broadening the framework staff are developing for the fund. McLaren argued the current direction risks becoming too restrictive and proposed a set of guiding principles: servant not gatekeeper, benefit of the doubt, prototype and pivot not plan and execute, direct engagement, and speed in enabling support.
What's important here is that we try something different, because what we've been trying so far seems to be making the situation worse. The plan that was described in the report under Direction 4, I believe, has pivoted away in a detrimental direction to the original intent and the actual help that these groups are providing to people in the city right now. And so what I'm asking is, please open your minds to a new way of doing things that has worked in other places.
Councillor Wendy Stephen opposed the amendment, saying Council still has a responsibility to ensure public funds are spent with appropriate oversight and accountability.
We just had a very lengthy discussion about fiscal accountability and transparency. And when I look at this, what I'm seeing is giving money, public money, to groups with no strings attached. That's what I'm hearing. And if that's private money, great, go for it. I'm not okay using public money in that way, so I can't support this amendment.
Staff told Council that while the proposed principles aligned with the spirit of the program, formally embedding them could create challenges when it comes to administering and evaluating applications.
I think one of the challenges that we would have in trying to understand these guidelines, Counselor, is that the scale and scope of their application is unclear. And if I may, just very quickly, the servant, not gatekeeper, asks us to set aside issues of compliance, but it is nonspecific in what areas where compliance would be set aside. Is this compliance on safety? Is it compliance on medical training? Is it compliance on park permits? It is tremendously unclear to staff, and staff would be in a hard position to understand the limits of that guideline. Benefit of the doubt opens questions of how would we evaluate any applications if we are to provide benefit of the doubt to anyone in their presentation. Prototype, pivot, plan, execute really asks questions about liability and financial exposure. I know this could be small dollar amounts, but there is $350,000, and depending on who applies, we've set no limit. An individual organization could receive over $100,000 in financial support, and we would have no guidelines around that. And then direct engagement in place in pre-award adjudication. Again, Council's initial motion asked us to consult with experts and those with expertise in these areas. And I think that this would, again, be another guideline or parameter that would be challenging for staff to understand.
Councillors Gary Osterov and Connie Glenn expressed support for the amendment, arguing it could improve the chances of attracting innovative proposals.
Sometimes regulatory controls are cramping. You know, we demand this and that, and we don't want to smother the good work that can be done, and maybe we need to look at new ideas. So I wrote down, listen better, ask how we can help, provide administrative support, come alongside, is what I'm reading from this. And I think that I don't think it's asking to be irresponsible with funds. That's not it at all. I think it's just maybe we need to have a fresh look so that we allow others to be the very best that they can be at what they're really good at.
If we are going to try and innovate and bring new solutions forward, we are going to have to find some way to be more flexible in how we look at things and to give consideration for new ways of doing things. I think the intent of the original motion was to open the door to new groups, not just the same groups, so that potentially we could make some greater headway with the challenges in front of us.
Ultimately, the amendment was defeated in a 9-4 vote. Even so, staff emphasized that their intention remains to encourage applications from new groups and organizations, not just established service providers.
Staff have always understood that direction. The original motion was clear that this was for new groups, bringing new and innovative ideas. The use of expertise was only as directed by council in the motion to seek support in the review of those submissions and the development of those criteria for consideration. So yes, staff have always understood and would continue to understand the intent of council here to support new and innovative opportunities. And again, the program as currently being structured is set up to mirror the Fines for Foods process, which also was trying to draw new groups forward to be able to support food security and sustainable food systems within Kingston. So a very similar model, but understood, Councillor, in context today as it was when originally issued by Council.
Staff say the pilot project framework is still being developed with a call for submissions expected later this summer. The goal is to have funding awarded by mid-September ahead of the CTS closure at the end of the month. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen reading a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about the future of Napanee's Village Green long-term care facility.
Thank you, Jesse. For nearly half a century, Village Green has been a part of the fabric of the village of Selby. Residents have spent their final years there, staff have built careers there, and families have entrusted loved ones to its care. Since opening in 1977, the home has been a fixture in the community, serving generations of locals. On Tuesday, June 24, 2026, Village Green officially entered a new chapter of its history as residents, staff, community members, and dignitaries gathered to celebrate the opening of the new Village Green long-term care home in Napanee, just a 5-minute drive south from the previous site. The new 128-bed facility replaces the original 66-bed home in Selby, more than doubling its capacity while carrying forward the legacy of the institution that began nearly 50 years ago. The opening comes nearly 3 years after dignitaries gathered on the drive-in road site for the ceremonial groundbreaking. The project adds 62 new long-term care beds and replaces the existing 66, part of a broader provincial effort to expand and modernize long-term care capacity. Yet much of Tuesday's celebration focused not on what is new, but on what has endured. Throughout the building, reminders of Village Green's history have been woven into the design. The home's four resident home areas bear names connected with its story. Pierce Lane honors longtime administrator Linda Pierce, who spent 35 years at Village Green. McFadzean Way recognizes longtime medical director Dr. Ian McFadzean. Richards Lane commemorates the Richards family who founded Village Green in 1977, while Selby Way pays tribute to the community where the home spent nearly five decades. Each home area accommodates up to 32 residents and has its own dining, activity, and lounge spaces. The intention is to make smaller neighborhoods within the larger institution. Ontario Minister of Long-Term Care Natalia Kusendova-Bashta, Hastings, Lennox, and Addington Member of Provincial Parliament Rick Berzay, Greater Napanee Mayor Terry Richardson, and members of Napanee Council joined residents, family, and staff for the celebration. The new Village Green includes therapy rooms, common areas, family gathering rooms, a salon, outdoor spaces, and other amenities designed to improve residents' quality of life. By relocating from Selby to Napanee, the expanded home will also allow more seniors to remain close to family, friends, and community connections that have long been central to life at Village Green. Rahim Hirji, President and CEO of Omni Quality Living, argued that the success of the long-term care home is measured by something less tangible. What makes this a home is the team member who learns how a resident takes their coffee, he said. He remarked that it is the nurses who notice subtle changes in a resident's health, the recreation staff who help residents reconnect with activities they once loved, and the employees who reassure worried family members. This, he emphasized, is all part of a larger family atmosphere. Hirji also acknowledged Residents Council President Kim Wickens and members of the Family Council, emphasizing the role both groups play in shaping life at the home. For Wickens, this is to ensure everyone who lives at Village Green feels included and represented. In many ways, the new facility reflects the generations of people who have shaped Village Green along the way, from the Richards family who founded the home in 1977 to longtime leaders such as Pierce and McFadzean, and to today's residents, families, and staff who help guide its future.
Thank you to Dinah Jansen and Michelle Dory Forrestel for that story. Coming up next, we have a story from Brenda Little, local journalism initiative reporter for CJPE County FM, with a story about the restoration of the Old Boys Memorial entrance.
I remember the night during a council meeting when Diane Kennedy, a petite elderly lady, stood in front of council with a request for funds to repair and restore the Old Boys entrance at the Picton Fairgrounds. At the time, she was the president of the Picton Legion, and her passion for honoring the history of the area, but especially for fallen county soldiers during several wars, was evident. The structure was built in 1920 as a memorial to the county soldiers who lost their lives during World War I. A lot of hard work and many hands went into the restoration, but finally the unveiling took place on Sunday for all to admire. I spoke with Diane Kennedy, now past president of the Picton Legion, current president Phil Dawson, and Mitch Smith, representing the legions from Wellington and Consecon. The three of you have had so much involvement with this project. Why is this project so important?
I personally live close by, and people didn't know the history of it and the significance of it. So basically, that was part of it. I like the whole community to realize that this is a war memorial to the veterans of the First World War, and make it so the building is useful again, and teach our children, and that's basically the reason, because it is part of our community, the history of the fair and the history of the military here in the county. So yeah, that was the basic reason.
Mm-hmm. And there were many groups that were involved with this restoration.
Well, that is one of the many wonderful things about this, is that everything from Diane, Legion, getting the ideas, to council, to then staff and community fundraising. And there's such a long untold story of all the background stuff that has gone on to make this actually an effortless endeavor. And we can see the results of that. So truly, we're grateful to be able to witnessing what's best about the community and coming together at all levels.
I just have to say that even coming here, I've learned something. you know, and I think it's important for everybody to know what the country's been through to have what we have today, and show more respect to everybody. So, yeah, it's a good education.
And the mural, what does it depict?
The history of the fair, the history of the military. It is a heritage building, and going forward, we would like to make the building useful so it doesn't fall into disrepair again. I think if the public knows and we use it, make this the entrance to the fair again. We have a little walkway here. I'd like to display the posters from all the schools are involved all through the county in poster and literary, and just so we can put them up and people can come and see. We marvelous art that we get, and post. They also poetry and essays. There's quite a large, all over Ontario, like yours and ours. They go to zone, then they go to district, and some of them even go on to provincial. So the kids earn a little bit of money, you know, so they're always very proud and they're always very willing. I know we get probably about 115 entries every year in the poster. So it's UTHAT as well as a memorial to our vets, and so people know what these guys did. It's like respect what these guys did so we could be free.
And the county played quite a role in this. I think a couple of the councillors made a motion to have this project start.
Yeah, so that's what I was referring to earlier. We had Diane with the incipient idea and a few others that were really the genesis of this. But people started getting on board, and we all know that in the public sector and communities, there's lots of opportunity and lots of need for funding. And so there is effort that needs to go into advocating for that and following it through. And these are really the untold stories and hours that the volunteers have put into. And that's why it's so wonderful to see the fruition of that today. It's such an excellent display. And I would echo what Mitch is talking about. We need to do a good job and a better job, and we take that responsibility to the Legions, the Royal Canadian Legions. You have three branches in the county represented here today, Picton, Wellington, and Consequin. But, you know, for the youth, and we have various opportunities to get the youth engaged so that they can appreciate, and indeed the adults can appreciate what we so enjoy, especially here in the county with its very storied history in both military and community efforts.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Now over to Ted Evans, LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, with a story about the extension of the Loyalist Link pilot program through to September 2027.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township Council approved the extension of the Loyalist Link pilot program to September 3rd, 2027. This will maintain uninterrupted service while the township waits for the outcome of their Ontario Transit Infrastructure Fund application. Funding for the extension will be provided through provincial gas tax allocations as well as fares. Beginning in September, the current 90A, 90B service will transition to a single connector route linking Bath, Odessa, and Millhaven to the W.J. Henderson Hub. This will align with the planned shift for Kingston Transit Route 10 to 30-minute intervals. According to staff, the combined ridership of the two Loyalist Link routes was over 9,600 in 2025 and continues to grow. Staff are looking to improve coverage, flexibility, and cost efficiency. They will be reporting back to Council with updated financial projections and service performance metrics following the release of the funding decision. Director of Community and Customer Services Lori McFarland noted plans for the future.
There is plans to increase ridership. We're trying to do that. Hopefully, you know, through the as presented, we're looking at on demand, which could bring some efficiencies. and might increase ridership as well.
Director of Corporate Services Strategy and Innovation, Jenna Campbell, spoke about waiting for the outcome of the funding decision.
We are limited right now in some of our actions that we can take while we're waiting to have the final OTIF application submitted to the province, because we have to remain in pilot status. So some of those opportunities may come to fruition a little bit more in terms of encouraging the growth of the ridership and that sort of thing once we have an idea of whether we'll be receiving that funding.
Councillor Paul Broderick showed his support for the program.
I remember going out for an early morning ride with Director Campbell around the first few weeks and, you know, sort of thinking, are we going to be the only two on here? But the data supports some growth. And I think that was the original thing we were worried about was, would people come thinking, oh, this is only going to last a year? You know, we're not going to change our habits, but I think we're heading in the right direction. And this is one thing I'm really proud that this council has done, is looked into that. And I hope that we can continue this down the roads. I think it's a viable service. And through personal experience, anytime you can get my kid on public transit, we're doing something right.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the Kingston Sports Report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays.
This is Jesse Bell with your sports report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. July marks the official start of the NBA offseason, and as such, we have a number of huge trades to discuss. The first trade announced that will be made official later next week is one that has been brewing for a very long time, as the Milwaukee Bucks have finally found a trade partner for their disgruntled superstar and former MVP, Giannis Antetokounmpo. Giannis and Bobby Portis will be traded to the Miami Heat for Tyler Hero, Khalil Ware, Jaime Jaquez Jr., Kasparis Jakusionis, the draft rights to Miami's 13th overall pick, Nate Ament, as well as a number of draft picks, including Miami's 2031 first-round pick, 2033 first-round pick, 2033 second-round pick, and a pick swap between the two teams in 2030. This is an interesting trade for both teams, the Bucks acquiring a lot of young talent and future draft picks, whereas Miami shed a ton of cap space, a lot of depth, and obviously a lot of future picks to pick up one of the five best players in the NBA today. This was not the only blockbuster deal announced, as there is a four-team trade involving the Minnesota Timberwolves, Charlotte Hornets, Brooklyn Nets, and Chicago Bulls. The Timberwolves will pick up superstar point guard LaMelo Ball alongside Josh Green and the 33rd overall pick in the draft, Isaiah Evans. The Charlotte Hornets will acquire Naz Reid, Minnesota's 2033 first-round pick, Minnesota's 2029 second-round pick, 2032 second-round pick, 2033 second-round pick, and a first-round pick swap in 2028, a first-round pick swap in 2029, and a 2030 first-round pick swap. So a lot of picks and Naz Reid going to Charlotte in exchange for LaMelo Ball. Brooklyn will acquire Julius Randle from the Minnesota Timberwolves, as well as the draft rights to Joshua Jefferson. And the Chicago Bulls will acquire Nick Claxton from Brooklyn. So a complex four-team trade, but what ultimately matters most is LaMelo Ball, fresh off his best season in the NBA, is being paired up with another superstar guard in Minnesota's Anthony Edwards. That's a wrap for today's sports report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Have yourself a happy Canada Day.
Thank you, Jesse, for that update. And also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with July 1st, Canada Day, and what a warm Canada Day it has been. High of 28, largely sunny conditions with a very slight chance of a thunderstorm. Feeling closer to 34 with that max UV index of 10. Thursday, July 2nd, we've got more warm weather in the forecast. Mostly sunny and humid. 28 is your high, feeling closer to 35, again with a UV index of 10. Friday, July 3rd, a little bit cooler, ever so slightly, by about a degree. 27 is your high, feeling about 33. Clouds, a little bit of sun, but an 80% chance of thunderstorms later in the day. Saturday, July 4th, 26 is your high, feeling like 33. Very humid, chance of rain in the afternoon, about a 65% chance of precipitation. Sunday, July 5th, 27 is your high, very humid, high risk of a thunderstorm, 75% chance of rain, UV index of 6. Monday, July 6th, cooling down just a little bit. 26 is your high with a 75% chance of rain. Feeling closer to 30, quite humid. Tuesday, July 7th, 26 is your high with a 55% chance of rain. And Wednesday, July 8th, 25 is your high with about a 60% chance of precipitation in the forecast. That's a wrap for your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. That's a wrap for your Environment Canada weather report. Coming up next is Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar for the week.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, community events, workshops, markets, or family-friendly activities, there's plenty of happening in Kingston this week. Let's get into it! Starting off with Monday, the Great Lakes Museum opens its newest exhibition, Aquaculture Farming the Waters, offering visitors a chance to explore the future of sustainable food production. Families can also enjoy live at the library Kingston Frontenac music together at the Isabel Turner branch in the morning. In the evening, Craft and Create returns to the Central Branch Library while Trivia takes over both the Brass Pub and Something in the Water Brewing Company. Live music includes Cameron Watts, Monday Residency at the Cove Inn, and the Mourning Doves at Museum. Tuesday features a few unique community events, including the Queer Song Circle, Singing for Connection and Well-Being, hosted through Queen's Thrive 365 at McIntosh Quarry Hall. The Crochet and Knit Circle also returns to the Central Branch Library, while Daft Brewing hosts its weekly Euchre Night. Live music includes Tom Savage's Tuesday afternoon happy hour jam at the RCHA Club, a pre-Canada Day party with 80s Enough at the Cove Inn, and Musiki's open mic. Wednesday is all about celebrating Canada Day, with festivities taking place throughout Kingston at Springer Market Square and Confederation Park, with live music, family activities, food vendors, and fireworks to wrap up the evening. And if you're looking to get out of the town, celebrations are also happening in Bath, Sealy's Bay, and Belleville. Music lovers can also enjoy performances from Los Gracia, Breakwater Brass, Hold the Door, Soulfire, Tyler Brett Forks, Vincent Moncier, and many more throughout the day. Thursday starts with the Kingston Public Market in Springer Market Square before the Tet Center hosts a needle-felted landscape workshop in the evening. Movie lovers can also head down for a free outdoor screening of The Devil Wears Prada beginning at 8:30 p.m. Live music includes Al Lerman at the Cove Inn, Clear Breeze at Hotel Wolf Island, Doug Reensbury at the Helm Dockside Patio, and the world's greatest tribute to the Traveling Wilsbury at the Sphere. Friday brings one of the biggest events of the week as the A Game Expo gets underway at the Slush Puppy Place, featuring gaming, exports, cosplay tournaments, and special guests throughout the weekend. CFRC also hosts an Airway YGK songwriting workshop with Savannah Shea, while the Royal Canadian Legion presents a paint night fundraiser supporting the venue's family toy box. Music highlights include Fred Eaglesmith at LaSalle Theatre, Ness as part of the Waterfront Concert Series, Tyler Brett Forks at Loyalist Golf Club, and Stereotypical at White Iris at Overtime Sports Bar. Heading into Saturday, the Kingston Public Market returns downtown alongside the Tet Center's Kid Creativity Club. The A Game Expo continues for its second day, while Confederation Park hosts the Saturday Sessions Concert Series featuring Dave Barton Trio, Two Thirds Down Under, and the Cliff Edwards Trio. Other live music highlights include Atiari at Spacer's Dockside, Noah Malcolm at the Cove Inn, Andrew Mack Band at the Turnog, and the Tony D Band at the RCHA Club. Wrapping things up Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market returns from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., while the final day of A Game Expo continues at Slush Puppy Place. Live music includes Purple Diamonds at Time Out Bar, Head Over Heels at the Cove Inn, and live band karaoke with the Oreos at the Merchant Tap House. That is your weekly events and concerts calendar for June 29th through the July 5th. For more information on these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. The events calendar is brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their upcoming shows and events throughout the season. I'm Jenny. Thanks for listening and have a great week, Kingston.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times.
Hello, and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are getting up to. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Emily Ferguson, who's doing a PhD in kinesiology under the supervision of Dr. Chris McGlory. Welcome to Grad Chat, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. And before we dive right into the research aspect, could you tell us a little bit about your academic journey up until this point? What brought you to Queen's for your PhD?
Absolutely, yeah. So I did my undergrad in kinesiology at Wilfrid Laurier University. And there, kind of like I'm assuming many kinesiology students, I was thinking about a career in an allied health profession like physiotherapy. But I got exposed to some research, particularly in the lab of Dr. Tom Hazel. And that really kind of gave me, I kind of caught the research bug a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so I had this kind of interest in muscle disuse, mitochondrial physiology, and kind of more metabolism. And then that kind of brought me to Queens and the SKHS, where Dr. Chris McGlory had just started as an assistant professor. And it's been really good to learn from him in terms of I was there when he started the lab, and now the lab has grown so much and is doing so many really cool projects. So I did my master's with Chris, or Dr. McGlory, and doing my PhD with Dr. McGlory as well. So it's been an amazing journey.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, it's exciting to be one of the first students in a new environment. So you get to, I mean, I know PIs have obviously lots and lots of knowledge, but it's their first time in a lab. So you get to learn a lot along the way as well about how to set up a strong lab. And it sounds like it is one because you have stayed this long. So
absolutely. And learning how to pivot during the pandemic was something that it's a very unique learning experience.
Yes. So I think wherever you will go next, you will be very flexible after a research career during the pandemic.
Absolutely.
So can you tell us a bit about your research topic? You mentioned a little bit there what got you interested early on in research, but what is your current PhD project?
So my current PhD project is kind of a couple different projects. So one of the projects that I worked on for my PhD was looking at sex-based differences in mitochondrial respiration and mitochondrial content. Mm-hmm. So really the question that we were answering there is when males and females are matched for aerobic fitness, are there differences in rates of mitochondrial respiration and mitochondrial protein content? Overall, we found that when females and males are matched for VO2 peak, so maximal oxygen uptake normalized to fat-free mass, which is a good way to match for cardiorespiratory fitness in males and females, that there was largely no difference in the substrates that we looked at with mitochondrial respiration. Granted, we only really looked at carbohydrate metabolism, so if there's differences in fat metabolism, that's something that can be looked at moving forward, and some other groups have looked at that as well. And then the big project for my PhD is just recently completed. It was part of a larger study by Dani Nyman. She's a PhD student in my lab. She'll be graduating soon as well.
Well, congratulations to both of you. That's exciting, finishing a big project and graduating. So.
Thanks. Yeah, August 2026, but who's counting? And so during that project, it was in collaboration with Dr. David Bardana, looking at the effect of omega-3 fatty acid and essential amino acid supplementation in individuals undergoing ACL reconstruction surgery, so knee surgery. And with that, we were looking at rates of mitochondrial respiration, and we're still doing some data analysis, but sample collection is wrapped up, and looking at mitochondrial respiration, mitochondrial content, looking to collaborate to do some more measures in terms of looking at redox status. So that's still coming to a theater near you kind of thing. But those are my main PhD projects.
Very cool. So lots of, it sounds like, recovery and understanding how the body changes after periods, different types of stress or disuse or things like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Okay. And I noticed in your interview form that your title is, or is this your PhD working title, or is this the official one? Mitochondrial responses to skeletal muscle disuse. Is that's the working title, or do you think that'll be the final?
We'll call that the working title.
The working title. Okay. Yes. No, it's hard to say right until the end, but yeah. So what is skeletal muscle disuse then? And can you give us some examples of how skeletal muscle disuse is studied in research? I know you touched on it a little bit, but can you give us a little bit more detail? And what are some of the effects of disuse on skeletal muscle? So what happens when you stop using things?
Yeah, exactly. So with skeletal muscle disuse, it's another way of saying physical inactivity.
Okay.
And so we might experience this in our lives when maybe the flu is going around right now. So anybody who's, at home, staying in bed, trying to rest up for about a week or so, that is like your step reduction model. So you're not getting your, if you're someone who counts your steps on your watch, you're not getting your 10,000 steps in a day. You're getting maybe like 500, a little bit less, a little bit more. And so like step reduction would be one example of skeletal muscle disuse or physical inactivity during our lives. But we might also have experienced periods of muscle disuse where you go through a period of bed rest or hospitalization. So let's say you have an elective surgery, for example, like a hip surgery or a knee surgery, where you have that period of recovery afterwards. And oftentimes it can, depending on your surgery, it can be a week, it can be a little bit longer, where you have those kind of periods of reduced stepping or reduced physical activity or reduced movement. Another example is if you've ever had a cast on, classic example of, you know, signing a cast for somebody when you're in elementary school. But when that cast comes off, usually they're left with an arm or leg that's, you know, a lot skinnier, a lot weaker than the other arm. And that's a really great example or classic example of muscle disuse. And so the way that we study this, so we can do step reduction studies where you take a group of people and you basically have them go through a period of reduced, like, walking or stepping. So they might go from, like, their 10,000 steps a day and maybe they go to, like, 500. And then they can you can study how they recover from that period of step reduction. You can also do single leg immobilization studies. And this is in the context of human. You can also do disuse studies in rodents as well, but specifically for humans, you can do single leg mobilization. So usually we would put, like, a brace on someone's knee, for example. We've previously performed a study doing that. Kaelin Pufal, our master student who became a PhD student recently, or will become a PhD student. He's about to defend his MSc.
Congratulations to him as well. Lots of lots of people moving up in your lab. That's great to hear.
Yeah. So if you put a brace on someone's knee and maybe they go around on crutches for 2 weeks, so that would be a single leg immobilization study. And in that single leg immobilization model, if you were to do that in a non-surgical population, that would be a simple disuse model. So if I was to leave this room and go put on a brace for 14 days, that would be simple disuse. But if I was someone who's going through a period of surgery, that's a bit more complex because there's a lot of other things going on physiologically in that period of muscle disuse, like inflammation, and there's a whole surgery happening. So it's pretty invasive.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And then another way you can do it in humans is bed rest. So we actually have two bed rest studies going on right now. Those are being led by Tom Tripp and Seb Camargos, postdoctoral fellow in our lab and a master student in our lab. So they've been very busy this fall. But in a bed rest study, you basically have a group of individuals. So again, this would be a simple disuse model where you grab your, you get your participant group and they would go through a period of just staying in a bed all day. So this could be like 5 days. There's some studies that look at really long periods of bed rest. Those are more kind of like space agency studies.
Ah, okay, yes.
And like anti-gravity. But for us, we were doing 5 days of bed rest in our lab.
Okay, and that would simulate a recovery from a lot of different types of elective surgeries. Right, yeah. Okay, yes. Not quite going to the moon and being in anti-gravity. You don't have to study that for a while. And I'm sure that would be incredibly challenging to recruit participants to do bed rest for like 3 or 4 months.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure 5 days is hard enough with participant recruitment.
I imagine with the colder weather, we'll see how it goes. I'm just picturing like curling up with movies and studying for exams, that kind of thing.
That's a pretty great pitch for, so for any of our listeners, if you'd like to participate in a bed rest study, the McGlory Lab has spaces for you this fall. So those are some great examples. So you can do single leg immobilization or you can stimulate bed rest like your lab is doing right now. And what are skeletal muscle mitochondria, as they are kind of, that's the lead in your title, and why is it so important to study mitochondria in this context?
Yeah, so skeletal muscle mitochondria, you probably know them from high school biology as the powerhouse of the cell.
Yes.
They are essentially, you can think of them as like the downstream kind of power plants of skeletal muscle cells, where mitochondria use the oxygen that we consume and the foods that we eat to produce energy or regenerate energy, if you want to be specific about it, in the form of ATP or adenosine triphosphate. And ATP is required for a lot of processes in our cells, so muscle contraction and muscle protein synthesis. And with disuse too, I didn't mention it earlier, but with muscle disuse, you have those kind of that reduction in muscle mass and strength. And in humans, the reduction in muscle mass, we think, is primarily driven by reductions in muscle protein synthesis. And we are fortunate in our lab that we are able to look at muscle protein synthesis. So we use stable isotope tracer analysis, and that's really been spearheaded by another postdoc in our lab, Dr. John McLeod. But with mitochondria, so for example, if you ate maybe like a bagel for breakfast this morning, that bagel is going to be broken down into carbohydrates. We'll have glucose going through the bloodstream. into skeletal muscle, glucose goes through a process called glycolysis, and then the downstream products of that go to the mitochondria, where we have the electrons donated from the byproducts of that glucose breakdown into the electron transport chain, and then we have the production of ATP. And so it's really important to study mitochondria because it allows us to look at metabolism. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned before talking about different substrates. So, mm-hmm. for example, like carbohydrate and fats. So we can look at how our mitochondria actually oxidize or use carbohydrate-based substrates to consume oxygen. And then in our experimental assay that we do, we have a couple of assumptions that we keep in mind, but it's usually a proxy of mitochondrial energy production. Mm. And that is currently actually, I think she's in the lab doing it right now, but Dr. Jen Wilkinson, our other, we have three postdocs, we're very fortunate, is doing a high-resolution respirometry assay right now to do that. So in our lab, we can actually look at how mitochondria are, oxidizing or using carbohydrates as substrates. And we can also look at fat oxidation, and we can look at a number of different pathways in mitochondria as well using that assay.
So you're able to see a lot from what the mitochondria are doing in response to this muscle disuse that's going on then, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah. So trying to interrogate the question of, is it mitochondrial dysfunction with muscle disuse, or is it just a switch in substrate utilization or fuel utilization?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense then. So has a lot of other research been done so far to examine the effects of muscle disuse or longer periods of muscle disuse on skeletal muscle mitochondria to date? And what does that literature look like if it exists?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, it does exist. In humans, the main kind of models that have been used where mitochondrial respiration or mitochondrial adaptations have been examined is largely single-leg immobilization and bed rest studies. With single-leg immobilization, and again, this is specific to humans, but it's mostly been simple disuse models. So again, using the knee brace in a healthy population or non-surgical population, and then bed rest studies as well. And what the kind of main findings so far are that mitochondrial respiration and mitochondrial protein content are reduced following a period of single leg immobilization. And in bed rest, it's largely the same, but it depends on the substrate that's been used. Sometimes there is no change. And that's also a product of the sensitivity of the measures that we're using as well.
So your lab is using many different methods, it sounds like, to test these things. And you mentioned that using the different types of substrates. And you're looking at omega-3 fatty acids specifically in this study? Is that and essential amino acids? Do you study other nutrients? And why omega-3 fatty acids and essential amino acids? Is there a reason for this in particular in your study?
Yes. So with essential amino acids, these are basically amino acids that our body can't synthesize. So we have to obtain them from the diet. And essential amino acids are particularly potent stimulators of muscle protein synthesis. Mm. And so then the idea is that with muscle disuse, we have a decrease in muscle mass. But then can we use nutrition, like essential amino acid supplementation, to preserve rates of muscle protein synthesis and therefore, attenuate or blunt the decline in muscle mass that happens with muscle disuse? But what's interesting is that with muscle disuse, our muscle might not respond to essential amino acids like it usually does in kind of this anabolic resistance. But omega-3 fatty acids have previously been shown to basically sensitize skeletal muscle to essential amino acid provision. So our question is really, are omega-3 fatty acids and essential amino acids able to work together to basically attenuate or blunt declines in muscle mass? We're still looking at muscle strength as well. There might be some more that we need to do on the muscle strength side. Previous literature looking at single leg mobilization would suggest that the essential amino acids are able to mitigate declines in muscle protein synthesis and muscle mass, but maybe not so much the muscle strength. So we're still kind of interrogating that question a little bit. And the omega-3 fatty acids is largely based off of Dr. McGlory's previous work during his postdoc, where he actually did a simple disuse model. They looked at young women going through a period of single leg immobilization, so this was 14 days, and what he found was that omega-3 fatty acids largely reduced the decline in muscle mass that happens in this population. And this was also coupled with mitochondrial respiratory analysis and looking at mitochondrial protein content. And they also found a protective effect of omega-3s on rates of mitochondrial respiration, mitochondrial protein content as well, which is kind of interesting how, you know, sometimes we might think of mitochondria and muscle contraction as kind of these two independent silos. Mm-hmm. But we're interested in looking at how they might actually be connected a little bit more than maybe what we think of right now. And then in terms of, do we study other nutrients? We do, not in the context of muscle disuse right now, but Noah Gittins and Ray Schnur, also master's students in our lab, are currently looking at the effect of polyphenol supplementation in older adults going through resistance band exercise and also cycling exercise. So that project just started, but I'm really interested to see how that goes because the polyphenols as an antioxidant might have a link with mitochondria. And Jen Wilkinson is also doing high-resolution respiration analysis on that those samples as well.
Wow, so your lab has a lot going on. That's a very exciting time to be a part of all of this great research. And I'm wondering, where do you see your research and maybe your lab's research more generally, where do you see this having an impact?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the impact of the research, if we can reduce the decline in muscle mass and strength following a period of disuse, that is pretty meaningful for a lot of people, not only in the sense of you are probably going to be able to recover faster and maintain function a little bit more and quality of life a little bit more. But the loss of muscle mass and strength is also, you know, kind of a predictor of poor outcomes. Mm. So, you know, all-cause mortality. Again, I kind of mentioned like the loss of function, loss of quality of life. So if we can mitigate muscle disuse atrophy, which is kind of this umbrella term for the loss of muscle mass and strength that happens with muscle disuse, then we can have kind of a favorable impact on a lot of people, whether it's, you know, coming out of surgery or if it's going to be, you know, longer periods of disuse that they're going to have to deal with throughout their lives for various reasons. Specifically with the mitochondrial analysis, it's a little bit, you know, less applied maybe. It's more mechanistic, but it's important to understand what's happening to metabolism at the cellular level, especially with muscle cells, because it will help us kind of interrogate whether there's a dysfunction that can be addressed with different strategies or whether it's a shift in substrate utilization. So whether your mitochondria are oxidizing more carbohydrates or fats or protein or amino acids, and what that actually means and how we can maybe, you know, use that to, again, impact different stress response pathways or other mechanisms of muscle loss.
This all sounds really exciting and very positive. I know from research to application, it can be a long journey, but the idea that your lab and your project specifically can help people identify, you know, what dietary changes they might need to make or incorporate into their lifestyles before, during, and after a period of muscle disuse. And what comes up anecdotally to mind, of course, is like those surgeries, like you mentioned, like a hip replacement or a knee replacement or something like bed rest for pregnancy or some other common periods where people find themselves not using their muscles in the same way they usually do. But to be able to impact those, because those, I mean, those are just some common anecdotes that come to my mind as a non-expert completely outside of your field right away, that, you know, a lot of people experience in their lifetime some type of period where they aren't using their body in the same way, and this might be able to help them a lot. And I know this is just very, very anecdotal, but a family member is an RPN who works on a recovery floor, and she sees the vast difference people have, you know, when they're able to start using their muscles again after a hip replacement or a knee replacement. She usually works with elderly patients primarily, and they've usually had a hip replacement, and the difference in quality of life if someone's able to get up and use their muscles sooner and than someone who, you know, stays immobilized a little bit longer. The difference is incredible. And if, you know, this person could just support their recovery by eating a better diet while they're in hospital, that sounds like a huge potential for improving care, especially as we have an aging population. I think we'll see a lot more a lot more people having those types of elective surgeries.
Absolutely.
In the next few decades. So and so it sounds like you have a lot going on right now. You've got a lot in the lab and a lot outside of the lab keeping you very, very busy, but you've also been involved in some other activities on and off campus. And can you tell us a little bit about what you get up to outside of the lab as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So outside of the lab, I am a member of Kingston Gets Active. Mm-hmm. So for those who haven't heard of it, Kingston Gets Active is really a kind of community initiative really led by some individuals out of the SKHS, Dr. Lucy Levesque, and we've got Kristen Cote and Ashley Johnson as our coordinators, and a really cool board this year. Like, everybody's really looking at how we can build our initiatives to increase physical activity participation, reduce barriers to physical activity for all individuals in the KFLNA region. So we have different things that we do throughout the year. There's also Kingston Gets Active Club on campus. The ambassadors are amazing. And we have Kingston Gets Active Month is now KFLNA Gets Active Month, so in March, when everybody's kind of coming out of our winter hibernation,
yes.
There will be lots of free activities through KFLNA Gets Active Month, and there's also the Active Pass program, and that is celebrating, I believe, its 20th anniversary, so that's pretty exciting.
Cool. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Active Pass?
Yeah, so for grade 5 and grade 9 students, mm-hmm. they get this Active Pass, and it allows them to do physical activity for, like, physical activity programming for free.
Very
so
nice,
it's
yeah.
it's really, I think, an awesome initiative, and mm-hmm. I wish I had it when I was growing up, but happy and really happy that we were able to celebrate that this year. And then I'm also chair now. I was chair-elect, but now chair of the Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology student committee. So we'll be doing some initiatives and promotion for, like, Meet My Methods May mm-hmm. and different things to kind of amplify the grad student voice among the CSET membership. And then in terms of what I do for fun.
Where do you have time left over?
Really ring at watching my sister play lacrosse and embroidering, hanging out with dogs. So,
oh, very yeah. nice. Okay, so you have, like, a very, very full and very diverse amount of things going on. I was curious, so how often do you play ringette now that you're in kind of the throes of your PhD as well?
Yeah. So with ringette, it's a tournament team. So,
oh, very nice.
It's actually run out of Ottawa. We'll have a training weekend mid-November. But it's basically like four tournaments or like four training weekends, and then provincials are actually here this year in Kingston, so there'll be an influx of ringette players around, and anybody who's interested should come watch.
Very cool. When is that taking place? When's provincials?
It'll be, I have to look up the exact date, but it should be like early March. Usually okay. It's February, but early March, so the weather will be a little bit nicer. Mm-hmm. You can, I don't know, the arenas might be a little bit warmer, maybe. But it'll be the AA provincials. So U14 AA, U16 AA, U19 AA, and then I'm on open AA. So it's kind of nice. I get to play with some of the girls that I actually played against growing up. It's a lot nicer when they're not. I'm a goalie, so
oh, okay.
it's a lot nicer when they're not shooting on you. They're shooting on someone else. But they're an amazing group of women, and I'm very excited to get back on the ice with them.
Oh, that'll be so much fun. And that is really cool to see, because did you play competitively growing up?
I did, yeah.
Yes, okay. So you would remember people from, oh, that person on that team has just got that wicked shot.
Absolutely.
And now she gets to do it on your behalf in the, yeah. instead of at you. So what a nice change.
It is really nice. You see them, like, picking up speed coming down the ice, and it's like, oh, yeah, here we go.
And is that comprised of women across the province? Are there any limits, or is it mostly folks from Southern Ontario?
So in this case, the team's based out of Ottawa. Okay. So it's, but we do have people commute from Toronto. That's yeah. kind of the beauty of Open AA is you play, you don't have to live in the city mm-hmm. where you play. Whereas growing up, it was largely that you had to be kind of in that general area. So I played in Waterloo growing up. But yeah, so you can commute from Ottawa and play for a team in Waterloo. A couple of years I commuted from Kingston to play for Waterloo. So yeah, it's kind of all over the place. Yeah.
Well, that's really great that you're able to keep an activity that you love going throughout your PhD in a way that sounds much more flexible and understands that, you know, everyone who's playing at the open level probably has a lot of other responsibilities going on as well, but still have love for the game and are still able to get together and do that throughout the year via tournaments instead of regular local practices or regular local games. So, oh, that's very nice.
Yeah,
and
we'll have to
keep an eye out in Kingston for provincials in early March 2026. So,
yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Well, Emily, it has been great chatting with you. Thanks for coming to the show, and good luck with the rest of your research. It sounds like you've got a really supportive and large lab to bounce ideas off of people, so I hope it goes very well as you continue on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's Dr. McClory has really created an awesome research team, and they're my best friends, whether they're in or outside of the lab. So, yeah, very fortunate.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. So best of luck on this project, and then all of the other folks that you're supporting as well. Best of luck to everyone in the McGlory Lab. Sounds like a busy fall with all the projects and all the studies that are underway. So best of luck to all of you as those continue.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Anytime. So we'd love to have you back, too, as your PhD progresses, and we'll have to hear some of those results, how they come out on the other end.
Absolutely.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFR Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week,